Welcome to Therapeutic Perspective. My name is Sarah Dynan, and I will be your host. Each episode, our goal is to educate clinicians on current issues presented in society and feature specialists that can help us to navigate these issues. As a licensed professional counselor in private practice in Northeast Pennsylvania with over a decade in the field, I am always wanting to learn more to better serve my clients. Especially as things in society evolve and change, I believe we need better access to current information. Therapeutic Perspective is a continuing education provider, so stay tuned to the end of the show to hear how you can obtain NBCC continuing education credit hours for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoy. Hey, welcome to Therapeutic Perspective. I am your host, Sarah Dynan. In this episode, we are going to be talking about cults. Cults have made headlines around the world for many years and continue to fascinate us in documentaries and, of course, popular podcasts. For example, a lot of you might recall the organization known as NXIVM. It gained a lot of attention for its Hollywood famous members. If you remember Allison Mack from the show Smallville, she was a member of NXIVM, which was led by Keith Raniere. They allured members by asserting themselves as a professional development program, which sounds so benign, but then it subsequently turned into blackmail and it branded its members and used them as sex slaves. The story behind these cults, the origins of the leaders and the demise are so fascinating and so, so very disturbing. We as mental health therapists need to know what some of these red flags are behind the cults so that we can better serve our clients if we find that they are being manipulated into an organization that can potentially turn abusive. We will also dive in to help those who are in cults find their way out and how to support family members whose loved ones are trapped in. So to help us on this topic, we have the author of the book Cults, Inside Out by Rick Allen Ross. So without further delay, welcome to the show, Rick.
Thank you, Sarah. Nice to be with you.
We are so excited to have you. And so to start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became involved in working with individuals in cults?
That began kind of serendipitously. I was just visiting my grandmother at a Jewish nursing home where she lived. She was in her 80s. And I found out that the paid professional staff had been infiltrated by a bizarre religious group that targeted elderly Jews. My grandmother was harassed, and I reported it to the staff. Eventually, there were five staff members that were dismissed from the nursing home that were involved with this particular group. And that began my experience as a kind of anti-cult activist, community organizer. And that led me to work at a social service agency in Phoenix, and then subsequently an educational bureau. And I served on many committees. And by the end of the 1980s, which is when I began my work, about 40 years ago, I was doing private consultation with families, what would be called cult deprogramming or interventions to rescue the victims of cults. And to date, I've done about 500 plus interventions across the U.S. and around the world. And my work also has brought me in contact with the judicial system. Because I have testified as a court expert in 11 states, including United States federal court. And as you mentioned, the book Cults Inside Out, that is kind of a compendium of my work and how I approach the issue of cult involvement. And it has a history of cults and so on. So my work has been quite involved over the years, and now it's been four decades since I began.
Wow. So you have so much experience, like in decades, and then it really all started from this personal experience, and it really kind of inspired you to open your eyes to look at this whole world that can be so damaging to its members and those involved and the family members whose loved ones are trapped in there.
I later found out that this same group was targeting people in hospitals And then I found out about another group that was targeting minor children without parental notification or consent. So these are issues that I think are troubling, because I think that everyone has a right to freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of religion. But there is a point, a boundary, where you cross the line and you're really infringing on the rights of parents, the rights of families, and the rights of individuals. And that's where I think that the cult issue becomes, you know, relevant.
I get what you're saying. Like, we, you know, there's obviously religious groups that spirituality, and we have that freedom of religion, but there's a part of it that turns really disturbing and really manipulative, especially when we're talking in terms of minors. Can you give us the definition and what constitutes a cult?
Well, my definition of a destructive cult is based on a paper published at Harvard in the 1980s, where a psychiatrist, Robert J. Lifton, he wrote this paper titled Cult Formation that was published at Harvard. So he identified what I would call the nucleus for a definition of a destructive cult, which are three core characteristics that virtually every other definition that I've ever heard intersect. The first is probably the single most salient feature of a destructive cult, which is an all-powerful totalitarian leader, typically a man, who has absolute power over the organization or group. Whatever he says is right, whatever he says is wrong, and the group is personality-driven and defined distinctly by that leader, who has virtually unchecked power and is totalitarian. Second, that leader uses a process of indoctrination that we have labeled as brainwashing, but what is really a synthesis of what can be seen as thought reform techniques, coercive persuasion, other influence techniques used methodically to gain undue influence over the individuals in the group. And then if we are to consider this group a destructive cult, Sarah, the group hurts people, and that varies by degree from group to group. So there are some groups that are much more destructive than others. That may be, there may be a group that simply wants your money, or they want to exploit you for free labor to generate cash flow. But then it can escalate, as you pointed out about Nexium, where there can be criminal activity, sex trafficking, racketeering, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and so on. So it's often important to keep in mind that there are groups that are less destructive, and also to keep in mind that there are groups that are less destructive that may evolve, as Nexium did, and become more destructive. And then there are also groups that the leader may die or the leader may be imprisoned, and the group has new leadership, and it may evolve and change and become less destructive.
So there's the potential there for reform, even within the cult, in a positive way, you know, especially as you mentioned, like if the leader were to pass away. Or there's this place where you can start something like Nexium, where it's benign, it seems good and it's empowering, but then it can kind of take this ugly turn into it. And it sounds like those three key characteristics. Number one is that leader that kind of dictates your worldview of what's good and what's bad. And number two is the thoughts and the control of the, can you repeat that a phrase to me? The thought.
The Robert J. Lifton wrote a book called Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. In that book, in the 22nd chapter, Lifton lays out 8 criteria to establish whether or not a group or organization is using a thought reform program. He based this on his research of North Korean POW camps in the late 50s, and his book was published in 1961. So what he would say is, like, I'll give you a few criteria. The foundational criteria is milieu control, or control of the environment. And that's the social isolation or even physical entrapment of members, where they are in a compound, where they cut people off, and they become isolated from family and old friends. And then another would be loaded language, a jargon in the group characterized by thought-terminating cliches that shut down critical analysis and critical thinking. Another would be the dispensing of existence, in which people who are not in the group are increasingly seen in a negative light, and there's a kind of we-they mentality, where we are the good guys, we are the chosen, and everyone else is at best negative, or at worst, perhaps demonic, satanic evil. So whenever you see these kind of characteristics, and Lifton says if six of the eight that he cites in the 22nd chapter of his book are evident, a thought reform program is present. And then Edgar Schein, who was a professor at MIT, he wrote a book about the same time, Coercive Persuasion, in which he identified the three stages of coercive persuasion. Number one, Schein would say unfreezing or breaking people down. Number two, changing them, manipulating them after they have been broken down. And then finally, three, locking them in or refreezing them in that change state. So when you're involved in a group and you feel that the group is beating you down or breaking you down as part of its process of education or whatever they claim they're doing, that is a telltale red flag that you're involved in a group that's using coercive persuasion.
I see. So it's kind of, there's that turning point there, that coercive persuasion that kind of really is what flips the switch.
I was just going to say that's what happened in NXIVM. Mm-hmm. When we read about these women that were in this group called DOS, which was a subgroup within NXIVM, and they were sex slaves, and they were literally physically branded as women under the control of Keith Raniere, though they did not perceive it that way because of the way in which they were deceived and led into the group. But what we don't understand is what it was like to be in NXIVM leading up to that point. So there were just untold days and hours and hours and hours of intensive training, coaching, manipulation, in which these people were broken down, changed, and then locked into a changed state of mind. And it was that that made them vulnerable so that Keith Raniere could exploit them.
Could exploit them. So that first part of it, it was like this very intensive program. There might have been some helpful facets to it that people benefited from, but then it kind of continued on into this very dark, manipulative place that people got locked into. And for us as therapists, when we talk about coercive persuasion, I want to kind of hit on this for our therapists. So a lot of therapeutic interventions are cognitive behavioral therapy, which we use the term cognitive reframing. And let's use the example for in cognitive behavioral therapy, somebody might say, nobody likes me. And so in therapy, we would kind of like examine that thought and we would look and say, well, it sounds like you have this best friend that you sit next to in school and she really likes you, or you have this coworker that you go to for everything and you actually just had lunch with your coworker the other day. And that is how we would do cognitive reframing. Like, can you explain to us the difference in cognitive reframing and then thought reform?
Well, I think that in therapy, in counseling, the therapist does not have a hidden agenda. The therapist is not deliberately deceptive, misleading their client. In fact, they're going to explain to their client what their form of therapy is, what methods they use within counseling, and that's all going to be part of an open and transparent disclosure from the very beginning. Whereas with NXIVM, it was everything totally the opposite. So they were deliberately deceptive. They told people, for example, that this was all about making the world a better place, changing the planet, creating a more ethical society, and that there was never any disclosure that, look, our goal is to totally control your life and to basically make you into a pawn that will serve the needs of Keith Raniere and this organization, and it will go against your own best interests. And that's one of the ways that you can see, Sarah, when people are under undue influence. They're acting against their own best interests, but consistently in the best interests of the group. And though the group may say that it's about science, it's about religion, it's about politics, it's about therapy, because there have been therapy cults like the Sylvanians, what they're really about is power and control. They like what they control. They don't like what they don't control. And everything they do and say is for the recruitment and retention of members, and ultimately their exploitation. So that is not the role of a therapist, a counselor who's trying to help someone and who is being very transparent and has no hidden agenda.
Mm-hmm. We have nothing to gain out of that situation, nothing to be gained, whereas the leaders of these cults, they have everything to gain out of it, their livelihood. Maybe it's money, financial, it's ego. So I think that's important that we kind of, because I know some of these words for therapists that are listening, they'll come up and they'll think, well, that sounds a lot like cognitive behavioral therapy. So I just wanted to hit on like the difference between the two. And you kind of mentioned in there religion, right? So especially with Nexium, the one that we've talked about during the show, they started gaining its members through professional development. And there's other organizations such as Scientology, which I think has gained a lot of media attention because of Tom Cruise's affiliation with it, Heaven's Gate. You know, what is the psychological purpose of using religion to recruit and attract members? How does that work?
Well, religion is, first of all, it's a facade, it's a mask. It's not really what the group is about. If it's a destructive cult, it's about manipulating and controlling people and exploiting people for the benefit of the leadership. But religion can give the group tax-exempt nonprofit status. It can eliminate the need to pay property taxes. It creates a shield legally in which, because of separation of church and state, the group is not accountable in the same way that even an educational nonprofit would be. Now, in the case of Keith Raniere, Nexium was a for-profit, privately held company, which dealt with seminar, human potential improvement seminars that the group staged and charged very substantial fees for. And so that was the gist of Nexium. Now, Scientology, which didn't begin as a religion, started with the book by L. Ron Hubbard in the 50s, Dianetics, evolved into a religion because I think Hubbard sought refuge and protection from regulators, from the federal government, by saying, look, the claims I'm making are spiritual claims, and therefore they are shielded by the First Amendment, and you cannot say that I'm involved in fraud or any type of chicanery because, look, it's a religion, and it's a matter of faith. And that gave Scientology not only a financial advantage because of taxes, but it also shielded Hubbard and ultimately David Miscavige, his successor, from any kind of meaningful accountability as to whether or not what they were doing really was science or scientific.
So it's really the main purpose is because of these protections that they would gain. And religion is one way to kind of gain that protection and self-preservation for the organization in itself. And, you know, you in your book, you kind of highlight all of the different organizations, the ones that we're really familiar with, the ones that were not certainly on my radar, the ones that haven't gotten as much media attention. But the one thing in your book that really struck out to me was you go into like smaller cults and family cults. And one of the ones you hit on is the story of Elizabeth Smart. And if you don't remember, she was kidnapped in the middle of the night from her bedroom at her home at the age of 14. And she was considered entrapped into a smaller cult. Can you explain to us how smaller cults and family cults operate?
Well, Brian Mitchell, who was the the man who abducted Elizabeth Smart considered himself to be a prophet. And he was a doomsday prophet, you know, proclaiming that he alone had the truth and so on. And for years, his only follower was a woman by the name of Wanda Barzi. And he was trying to recruit other people, but he failed to do so. And then the way, of course, he recruited Elizabeth Smart was by putting a knife to her throat. And what Brian Mitchell did was he broke her down. He abused her. He raped her. He isolated her from everyone and everything. And she became his creature for about 9 months until she was found by the police outside of Salt Lake City. Ultimately, she overcame the programming, the manipulation of Brian Mitchell, and she faced him in court, and she's become really a spokesperson for the victims of people like Mitchell. Other people can be involved in an abusive controlling relationship, which I point out in the book, and I've done interventions to get people out of such relationships where it's a one over one relationship and one person is all powerful and the other person, usually the woman in the relationship, is being abused and manipulated. And it also can take the form, Sarah, of a family cult where a parent, typically the father, but at times the mother, becomes the absolute authority in the family. And everyone and everything outside of the family is suspect, and the family may live with and stay with that parent indefinitely, even as adults. And there have been a number of families that have existed like this. Some of them have come to our attention when children escape and seek refuge with the authorities. And then their parents are arrested, they're prosecuted, and we read about it in the press. And so J.C. Duggart was rescued from such a group where she was held captive after being kidnapped and gave birth to children by the man who abducted her. So it can happen in the context of a family unit, or it can happen in a one-on-one relationship, or it can happen in a very small cult where there's just one leader and a couple or a handful of members.
Yeah, so I think that's important for us to remember as therapists when we think of cults. It's not just these larger organizations, but we can see some of the manipulative techniques like starting in those family cults. Are there any particular red flags that you would encourage therapists to be on the lookout for if an individual is part of a family cult outside of the obvious, like J.C. Lee Dugard and Elizabeth Smart, who were kidnapped? But what are some of the red flags if there's no kidnapping involved? It's just within that intimate family unit. What would be some of the red flags that would be concerning to us as therapists that this could be a smaller family cult being organized within there?
Sarah, I think the first red flag is social isolation or increasing isolation, control of information, control of association with other people outside of the family or outside of the group. And so what you see are people that are in our common, you know, situations today where they're always texting and they're finding out if it's okay to be with this person or be with that person. And you're seeing that maybe even in a session of a therapy session, that they don't turn their phone off, that there's an intrusiveness of someone or a group that is constantly monitoring what's going on. And that they always have to check with the authority figure to make sure that they have permission to do whatever. So in a very controlling family, you can see that. In a controlling cult, you can see that. And of course, when there is religion involved, and there frequently is in these family cults that I'm mentioning, or as in the case of Brian Mitchell that abducted Elizabeth Smart, you see this kind of weaponizing of religion. And it's used to denigrate and eliminate anyone or anything else that would be a competing narrative with the leader of that group. and the leader is zealously controlling in that sense. So the leader will say, well, those people are satanic, or those people are not living according to the word of God, or those people have negative karma, and they're an old soul because they didn't get it right, and they're being reincarnated over and over again because they're making the same mistakes over and over again. So they have some diminishing way of describing people, and you hear that kind of jargon being repeated by the person that you're dealing with.
I see. So it would be kind of this, like, obsessively, you know, making sure, seeking permission to do things, even sometimes very benign, maybe even in regards to, like, what they're wearing. I could see that, or maybe what they're eating. It can really kind of infiltrate their whole lives with how much the leader, or it could be the parent of that family, are having this influence on the person, and then demonizing anybody on the outside and using religion as a reason to demonize them. Like, oh, they're not following the word of God, and so we can't associate with them. I think it's really important to kind of tend to, and maybe even doing like a bit of a gut check. It sounds like in a lot of the manipulation that takes place in these cults, like, that gut check is thrown out the window. You don't have any of your own feelings or reactions. It's all dictated by the leader. So kind of encouraging our clients to kind of check with how they're feeling about the situation before, like, that natural instinct is taken away, but kind of re-teaching them to do that gut check. Like, does this feel right? This kind of seems like a lot. And maybe kind of questioning that.
Well, Sarah, you've touched on a couple of things, again, going back to Lifton and thought reform and his 8 criteria. So the individual is encouraged to embrace what Lifton calls the demand for purity. And also another criteria, doctrine over person. And what that means is that the leader of the group causes people to do a kind of personal inventory, in which those feelings, thoughts, and actions that are not consistent with what the leader calls the doctrine or the truth or whatever the preeminent belief system is of the group, they need to purge that. They need to purge that. And this also locks together with the demand for purity. So for example, if they have a gut feeling that something is wrong, they're told that gut feeling is inconsistent with purity, that the group is good and pure, and if they have a gut feeling that something's wrong, that's a negative feeling, a negative spiritual infestation or something, in which they need to rip that out. They need to eliminate that from their mind. And so this is a way in which groups can insinuate themselves in our thought processes, in our emotions, because they are telling us that those thoughts and those emotions that are inconsistent with what we're teaching are impure. And based on the demand for purity, you must eliminate them. And you must constantly check everything against the doctrine that the group leader is teaching. And anything inconsistent with that doctrine must be left and abandoned. So this is the way in which people insidiously are controlled by these type of group leaders.
Is taking any sort of, like, natural instinct for doubt and hesitation and putting a name to that as saying it's the devil kind of take you over. It's that negativity trying to get in. We're pure. Let's rid ourselves from that, rather than that person having natural feelings and emotions. It's almost like their goal is to turn them into, like, robotic. Like, you don't have any feelings for yourself. We are 100% in control of that. The leader is in control of that.
Yes. In Scientology, for example, they talk about the negative reactive mind. And they talk about what they call suppressive persons, or SPs, or potential trouble sources, PTS. So that in that way, they can label anyone that challenges their narrative or any thought that you have as being negative and something that you need to purge. And of course, they have a process for that, which is called auditing. And that's where a Scientologist will sit with a person called an auditor or a spiritual counselor. And these are what they would regard as kind of therapy sessions, though they would not admit that because they're diametrically opposed to any type of mental health professional that might offer an alternative to what they define as the only science of the mind that is acceptable, which is Scientology. So you're sitting across from this auditor, you're holding two metal cans that are connected by wires to a box called an E-meter, and they will say it measures the negative reactive mind. But in reality, it's what we would understand to be a galvanic response measuring apparatus, which means that it measures nervous tension. So the auditor says to you, how is your day going? And you say, well, it's going okay. And the needle moves, indicating some nervous tension. They're going to drill down into that. What is wrong today? What I'm sensing that something is wrong. Tell me what's wrong. Or they talk to you about your family and you say, oh, I'm getting along great with my family. But how is your relationship with your siblings? Well, and the needle moves. So then they're going to drill down into that. And then they're going to take copious notes. And that's going to go into what they call your pre-clear folder. Because in Scientology, you pay for revelation. You pay for spiritual counseling. And eventually you reach what they call clear, which is you have reached a certain level of status in Scientology. And then from that point forward, you're going up what they call the OT levels or operating thetan levels, and you go from 1 through 8. So all of this is constructed to basically, in my opinion, break people down, manipulate their thoughts, their feelings, and bring them into a position where they're completely subservient to what Scientology teaches as the truth. And people can pay hundreds of thousands of dollars, Sarah, to reach operating thetan level 3 or a great deal of money just to get to clear.
And I hear the money part of it, too. Like, if we take it down, we're not, for those of us who hopefully aren't affiliated with cults, like, I will look at genes, right? I will try to convince myself that the genes that are $100 are much more valuable and I love them that much more than the $20 genes, right? So when you are paying for it, you tend to look at it in a different light and almost try to sell yourself and rationalizing why you're doing it. So if you're investing all this money into like an organization like a Scientology, you might look at it and say, yeah, you know, this is worth the investment because, man, my bank account is at zero right now. So it better be worth the investment. And you kind of convince yourself of the value that you're getting out of it. Is that part of the manipulation that goes on? Why there's such a high price tag to these things?
Well, I think there's a high price tag because Scientology, in my opinion, is very focused on money. Mm-hmm. I mean, when L. Ron Hubbard died in 1986, his fortune was estimated at $600 million. Today, Scientology is what I hear, $3 to $4 billion is what the organization is worth. So how did they get so much money? From donations, from courses, from auditing. And also they have this staff of people that they pay very little money to. That's called the C organization that staffs all their facilities. And some of the most intense complaints of abuse come from these people involved in Sea Org. In fact, there was a lawsuit recently filed in Florida by former Sea Org members. And many of these Sea Org members are the children of Scientologists. So they were raised in Scientology. They may have gone to a Scientology school. And there they were basically passed through to Sea Organization. I actually did an intervention, Sarah, with a girl. She was 14 years old, and her brother was a Scientologist, and he had recruited her into Scientology, And her parents contacted me and they said, you know, Scientology has sent us forms to sign and return to them that would relinquish our parental rights over our minor child, our daughter, who is now 14. What do you think? And I said, well, I think it's outrageous. Why would you do that? You shouldn't even consider that. And she's going to be in C organization, and you may not be able to readily communicate with or visit with her subsequent to that. So they brought me in, and I worked with her, and ultimately she decided not to continue with Scientology. But that's how intense it can be, that children can actually be recruited into the C organization.
And especially at 14, you know, we as therapists know about like the developmental mind, and you're so impressionable at that age. And you can see why they would seek out to recruit some of minors, because it's maybe that much more easy. That's, you know, because of the that age and where they're at in that stage of development. Can you talk to us like about like interventions and the concept of deprogrammers? Like, what does an intervention and deprogramming look like?
Well, in some ways, Sarah, it's like a drug or alcohol intervention. It's staged as a surprise. You do not give the person advance notice typically, because you are trying to avoid the interference of the group or the leader to sabotage the intervention effort. And then when you sit down with the person, the intervention includes family members, close friends who have decided that they want to participate, and I'm working with them like a team.
Okay.
And there might be an ex-member present or someone who had a similar experience that shares that in the intervention. And then the intervention itself will go on for usually 3 or 4 days, though I will meet a day in advance or 2 days in advance with the family members and those that will participate to help them understand what to do, what not to do, so that we're all on the same page. And basically these 3 to 4 days, 8 hours a day, so we're talking about 24 to 32 hours, are taken up in an educational process and discussion. So this is not about counseling. This is about educating and sharing information. And there are 4 blocks that are going to be covered in an intervention. I write about this in great detail in my book, Cults Inside Out. And then I also offer case vignette examples and different categories of groups. So the first block is defining a destructive cult, or defining an abusive controlling relationship. How could you recognize that? What are the symptoms? What are the telltale warning flags? And does that resonate with the person's experience that you're working with in the intervention? Number 2, what is coercive persuasion? How does that work? What are its stages? What are the criteria to recognize that as a form of manipulation to gain undue influence? Number 3, what about the group or the leader do you not know that you should know to make a more informed decision about continuing with that group or leader? Have they been keeping information from you? Have they been lying to you? Have they misled you? What factual information is available that you should be aware of? And then finally, number 4, why did your family and friends come together for this intervention? What specifically caused them to be worried about you? What changes occurred? Were you giving a lot of money to the group? Were you abandoning your job, your education? Were you communicating less and less with your family and your old friends? What was going on that caused the family concern? So you cover those 4 areas, and there's this constant discussion going on, and the family is saying, well, we witnessed this and we saw that, and they're contributing their firsthand experiences. And then I'm kind of facilitating everything, And then I'm laying out all of the research and so forth. And at the end, they have the option of, you know, going back to the group, continuing with the leader, or maybe taking a break, or they might even say, I'm done. About 70% of the cases that I've been involved in, the person at the end will say, I'm taking a break, I'm done. And typically, if they take a break, they don't go back.
Okay.
In about 30% of the cases, the person usually will leave in the first day, day and a half. That is when the failure occurs. And then they will go on with the group. But it is my hope and the family's hope that at least some of the information that we've shared will be thought about, will percolate, and perhaps cause them to leave at a later date.
So it's almost, if we deem it as not a success, like the person returns to the cult, the idea is that you still were starting to plant seeds, like still started, you still reach them in some way, even though they didn't fully leave. And I think even a lot of them even saying, I'll take a break, that's a great answer, because they might need to sleep on it a little bit. You're not pressuring them to leave right at this minute, but taking a break might be the first way to kind of get them to leave. So it's a really intensive couple days there.
Well, you know, Sarah, I would say that the key to a destructive cult's control over an individual in many ways is they need to be plugged in. They need to be recharged. So there's this program that the group has instilled in the mind, and this is taken place through their intensive indoctrinational process. But in order to keep that program running, it needs to be empowered, it needs to be recharged constantly. So if you can get the person to unplug from the group for a period of time, then that program kind of runs down, and it's not being recharged. And what takes over is the individual's own individual critical thinking. They regain their autonomy, and they can reflect and evaluate the group on their own, rather than allow the group to constantly interpret everything and superimpose their narrative on everything. So I think when the person has that ability to unplug, and I'll frequently say to them, look, if this group is all they say they are, and the leader has nothing to fear, and the group is a great group, and they're honest, and they have integrity, they will allow you to take a break, because they know that they're good, and that you'll come back because they're good. If they're so worried that if you're unplugged, you're not under their constant surveillance and control, what does that tell you?
Yeah.
That maybe they're afraid of a counter narrative, that they're afraid that an outside frame of reference, an alternative perspective, is their enemy. I mean, how can that be if what they are is real and true? So I would encourage people to take that break. And as I said, about 7 out of 10 will do at least that. And then once they're no longer under the control of the group and they're free to think on their own, usually they will think their way out.
So it's all about getting that break. And you're absolutely right, which you can understand why they try to isolate its members, because other people are going to be trying to get them to take a break, move them away, and they don't want that influence. They want to constantly keep in their ear, constantly keep them charged to keep their affiliation with the group strong.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why they come up with these bizarre thought-terminating cliches. Like in the Unification Church, they actually would call independent thinking, really, they labeled it stinking thinking. And in Scientology, they'll say, well, that's your negative reactive mind. Or in certain Bible-based groups with extreme authoritarian leaders, they'll say, well, that's not you thinking. That's Satan attacking your mind. Satan's got a hold of you. You need to rebuke Satan. And so they have these devices, these thought-terminating cliches, this jargon this way of characterizing anything other than what they want you to think as being negative that cuts you off from following your train of thought all the way through and analyzing what's going on. Look, Sarah, out of all the hundreds of people that I've deprogrammed over the years, five of those people that I worked with were medical doctors.
Wow.
One was an orthopedic surgeon, another was a well-respected anesthesiologist. In one case, I helped a clinical psychologist get out of an abusive, controlling relationship that she could not see objectively, even though her parents did, and were worried about her physical well-being because she was being beaten and abused by her husband. So people who are very intelligent, very well-educated, who come from very good backgrounds, they do get trapped. They do come under the undue influence of groups and individuals like we're talking about. So I think people need to disabuse themselves of the idea that this only happens to stupid people or weird people or people with pre-existing mental illness.
That and like vulnerable populations, you know, like you were talking about, like the elderly, you know, vulnerable populations. Like I definitely see sometimes recruitment, or I've heard stories of recruitment out of like AA meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's people that are really trying to distance themselves from their identity as an alcoholic. And that's like prime for somebody to say, hey, you know, I can give you another identity. Come join this organization. It's great. It's positive. We'll give you something else to kind of replace your alcoholism. So it's and also very highly successful people who are not part of a vulnerable population, like you're saying, doctors and really well-educated people. Anybody can become a victim of a cult and manipulation.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all have vulnerabilities, and they can be exploited. They can be leveraged by a particular group. You talk about AA, Charles Diederich, who was the leader of a cult called Synanon, which started out as a drug rehabilitation community to help addicts, alcoholics, etc. Diederich himself was an AA guy, and so he recognized that this was a vulnerable group, and that they were experiencing difficulties in their lives, and they were looking for a way out. They were looking for help. And Diederich used that to pull them into Synanon. And yet he came up with this slogan, today is the first day of the rest of your life. A very laudable slogan. And Synanon seemed good in the beginning, and people respected it. But ultimately it ended with Diederich involved in a criminal situation where he tried to murder a friend of mine, Paul Morantz, an attorney who was representing former Synanon members suing Synanon for personal injuries. And so Diederich ordered a rattlesnake to be placed in Paul Morantz's mailbox, and he almost died. And there were many criminal things going on in Synanon, and eventually it was shut down. But in the beginning, it was all about rehabilitation, helping people get off the sauce, off the drugs, and it was seen as a positive thing. And so I think that all of us are vulnerable. And for example, if you're going through a difficult time in your life, which is the most consistent narrative I hear from former cult members, I was recently broken up with my romantic interest, my boyfriend, my girlfriend. I was going through a difficult divorce. I lost my job. Someone close to me died. I was depressed. I was feeling kind of sad, and I was looking for relief. And it was at that time that I had the bad luck to be approached by someone I knew, could be a coworker, a family member, a friend, who was involved in a group that some have called a cult. And then they told me just enough to get me through the door, but not enough for me to understand what the group was really all about. And so I got involved on the basis of my need at the time, my pain, but at the same time, my trust of this person who ushered me in. And we all go through bad patches in our lives. Sarah. So I think it could happen to anyone. And that's my experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think us as therapists, you know, obviously we'll most likely see people when they're in bad patches of their lives. I think it's important for therapists to be aware of if that person is then falling victim to some organizations that could have malicious intention, to be preying upon our clients who are sitting there, who are struggling, and to help for us to be aware of what potentially could be going on and to help educate them and to help them be aware of the red flags. Let's talk about like the therapist role in cults. You know, I know you talk about interventions and deprogramming, you know, therapists were not trained to deprogram people, but what do you find as like a mental health therapist role in helping those who are victims in a cult?
Well, I mean, it depends on where the person at is, the victim is at in their journey. And I've worked with, for example, a group called Wellspring Retreat, which was a licensed mental health facility in Albany, Ohio, that was led by a man now deceased, Dr. Paul Martin, a clinical psychologist. And I've worked with other counselors that basically would work with someone that I brought out of a group and then subsequently help them in post-exit counseling. And I think the primary issue is to they would probably reinforce the idea that, well, you know, did this group take advantage of you? Did they exploit you? And can you identify that? Are you clear about that? How do you feel about that? And of course, you're dealing with trauma. And depending upon the group, some groups are much more traumatic than others. And it would depend on how long that person was in the group and what type of group it was. And some groups would inflict much more damage than others. And then I think it's a question of saying to that person, and this is very important, I think, what do you think in your life were the vulnerabilities that made you susceptible to this particular group? What did they exploit? How did they do that? Because I think if you can identify the individual's vulnerabilities, it helps them to understand how to protect themselves from any future involvement with a situation like that. And I think that's a palpable fear that people have going into therapy. Is this going to happen to me again and again? Am I going to be exploited by other people, other cults? How can I defend myself? I mean, I thought I was a strong person, but then this happened. And so I think helping the person by identifying their vulnerabilities, and we all have them, and it doesn't mean that we're shaming the victim. What we're doing is just affirming their humanity and the fact that they are a human being with vulnerabilities, and recognizing them will help them to protect themselves.
And recognizing them, normalizing them, because it seems like when somebody comes out of a cult, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of shame, there's some post-traumatic stress. I think there could be depression because that cult ultimately built your whole support system, your best friends, and maybe some of your family members are still in there. So like grieving that loss of your loved ones. So some depression can kind of come out that we'd be treating. Are there any like really big, like, do not do this if you're a therapist seeing somebody after a cult, or anything that you feel like we should absolutely stay away from doing when somebody's fresh out of leaving a cult?
Well, I think if someone is, let's say they were in a Bible-based group, which is a very prevalent category of cult groups in the United States because of the history of the United States and the fact that we are very religious as a Western industrialized country. I think that if you start quoting Bible verses and presenting somehow your view of the Bible, that's a big no-no because that can be triggering. And you want to be careful not to, trigger them going back into their cult mindset and becoming very frightened and apprehensive. And then another thing, I think you have to never in any way shame that individual. You don't want to make them feel that they were to blame. You want to make it very clear that they were preyed upon, that there was a predator-victim relationship, that they may have vulnerabilities because all people do, but that doesn't mean they're responsible for the predator's behavior and the fact that they were preyed upon and exploited. And because I think cult members are really frequently, as they leave the group, they're suffering from low self-esteem. They have a lot of self-doubts. They're thinking, how did this happen to me? What's wrong with me? And you don't want to feed into that narrative in any way. You want to empower them and make them feel that you are a good person. You're out of the group now. You're beginning your journey. You recognize what was wrong. Good for you, you know, and you want to help build them up and not shame them or blame them in any way.
Yeah. So making sure that it's an empowering therapeutic approach, very strength-based therapeutic approach, and helping them to kind of start over, like potentially rebuilding their own social network and normalizing that people are vulnerable, not shaming them for it, and just really using a strength-based approach for therapists who are out there listening who are familiar with strength-based interventions. It's important to really handle those who are victims of a cult, like with very gentle hands, just like we do all of our other clients, with kindness, with empathy and understanding. Do you feel like there's anything we can do from a mental health prevention standpoint? Like in your wildest dreams, what would you love to see to help prevent individuals becoming victims of cults?
More education on critical thinking. More education on what is thought reform, what is coercive persuasion, what are influence techniques. Robert Cialdini is the author of a famous book, Influence. Cialdini was a professor at Arizona State University, and his book identifies the six basic principles of influence. For example, authority, that we would submit to someone we perceive to be an authority or be in an authority position. Liking. We are more likely to agree with and cooperate with someone we like than someone we don't like, which accounts for what is called love bombing in cult groups, which means that you enter the group and they just are very loving and they just overwhelm you with their love and their warmth, and you like them. And therefore, you are more likely to go along with what they want because of that principle of liking. So I think in an ideal world, children, eighth grade, high school, would begin to become familiar with the principles of influence, the building blocks of thought reform, understand the coercive persuasion process, and then they would be more equipped to critically analyze and distinguish a good group from a bad group based upon the way they behave, not what they say they believe, which I think is an important distinction. Because I'm not trying to criticize what people believe. I think it's all about how they behave. Do they hurt people? How do they hurt people? Based on the evidence, based on the facts.
You know, and I think that opens up like a big thing that we want our listeners to take away from the show is that critical thinking piece of it that we can pass on to our clients and help them learn about. And not so much about the beliefs, but about the behavior is so important to really tend to and really pay attention to, especially as people. And I love that you say it's like eighth graders, like that preteen, pre-adolescent, early adolescent stage is a great opportunity to hit on this, because like we said earlier in the show, it's a very impressionable population. And ultimately in their brain, their goal at that stage is to help define who they are. And, you know, you always see adolescents trying to deviate from the norm by the way that they dress. They want to be seen as unique. They want to be seen as being part of something and identifying with a group. And if we can catch them at that stage to learn about what that really means to be part of a group. Sure, that group might have really beautiful, positive beliefs, but how do they behave? Is kind of what you're saying that you would love for that to explore.
Sarah, what I would say is the primary target audience or the primary target group for cults historically has been 18 to 26. So basically they go after college kids and they're constantly being reported about, or they have been reported about working on college campuses. Though I hasten to point out that now in the day of social media, Instagram, YouTube, you know, Facebook, Reddit, that there are groups that are recruiting on all of those platforms. And that has been becoming much, much more prevalent than going on college campuses. But still, that 18 to 26 demographic is really a main area of focus for a lot of these groups to recruit people. So if we can help educate people before they are 18, so that when they go to college, they understand this, and when they're online and they're in social media and they're exchanging ideas with people, they get this. They understand that there are predators online and that there are predators on campus, and they need to be prepared. So when I taught for the Bureau of Jewish Education in Phoenix, my classes were with juniors and seniors in high school. And for years, I would get postcards and letters from young people that I had worked with saying, wow, you know, it happened to me. I was on this college campus. Somebody started to come on to me. They acted really friendly. And I did what you said. I was suspicious because of what I had experienced in the class and what we had discussed. And I said, are you involved in some religious or political organization on campus? And then they answered my question with a question. Why are you so worried about that? And I immediately remembered what you said, meaning me in the class, that if someone answers your question with a question, they're being deliberately evasive. And so I confronted them and I said, why are you evading answering my question? And then they said, hey, I got to go. And they left. And I got this, you know, chill, realizing that I had been dealing with a cult recruiter. And so that is the kind of awareness that we need to raise so that young people, when they go on campus, they're away from their family, they're away from home, they're away from their support system, or they're online and they're basically on their own online and they are can be victimized, that they're aware of all these things so that they can defend themselves.
I love just that one quick little like litmus test that you taught that group is to say, okay, ask them what their affiliation is. Like, are you affiliated with a religious group or a political group? And if they answer you with a question, that is a huge red flag to distance yourself from it. That's like a great first takeaway. And that is something I think us in our therapy offices that we could really kind of help in developing those critical thinking skills is to kind of pass that on to our clients, especially as they are going off to school. You know, I work a lot with the adolescent population, and I think that's an important thing to kind of help them explore and talk about, because they're all very excited to meet friends, join groups and organizations, which they might not be aware of what some of these groups and organizations stand for and how manipulative they can be.
Yeah, I think that's the name of the game. They know what they're doing and you don't. And if you don't understand that they're approaching you with an agenda, how does that empower them and disempower you? So you need to, you know, have your critical thinking skills honed and be a bit of a cynic, be a questioner, and not just simply go along with whatever out of politeness. And also another thing that I think is a very valid point is when you're feeling really bad and someone asks you to come to some kind of group introductory meeting or some type of Bible study or something in a new group that you don't know about, and you're feeling bad and you're going through maybe a rough patch, it's okay to just look at them and say, I'm not up for it. I just don't feel good. And I don't think this is a time for me to do something like that. And recognize that you're in a vulnerable state. And I think that's another protective mechanism that we can use.
Yeah. Just so we can notice the people that are encouraging us to go with a certain group that we're unfamiliar with to help us with our vulnerability. That could be like a huge red flag. I mean, it could be very therapeutic and helpful if somebody's like struggling, but like being really aware, maybe doing your own research. If it's a group that you've never heard of, you've never just showed up in town, you know, do a little bit of research and just kind of really being aware.
Yeah. And Sarah, keep in mind that the person who's approaching you is most likely a true believer. Mm-hmm. So they're not, they are, if they're a lower level person in the group, they're not the top leadership. They truly believe that the group has all the answers. Like Allison Mack, when she was in Nexium, she was actively trying to recruit other actors in Hollywood. And they've talked about it. You know, Kristen Kreuk was involved for a while, or who was played Lana Lang in Smallville.
Yeah,
she left before things got really bad, thankfully. But there were others, you know, Katherine Oxenberg, the actress who I worked with, and her daughter, India Oxenberg, who became involved. Katherine and her then husband, the actor Casper Van Diem, became involved in Nexium. They thought it was good. And on that basis, they brought their teenage daughter, India Oxenberg, into Nexium. And India became involved because her parents were involved. She didn't question that. She thought, oh, well, you know, mom and dad think it's great, so I'm going to be involved. And then they recognized that something was wrong, and they left. And then they realized, oh, my God, we can't get India out. And it was this long process that Catherine went through. And I'll tell you, if it wasn't for Catherine Oxenberg, I think Keith Raniere might have gotten away with it, because there had been so many complaints from former members and families about illegal activities and abuse for years that I'm aware of, going back to the early 2000s, that were ignored by law enforcement, ignored by people in Albany, New York. The Albany Times Union would report about it, but it would just be swept under the rug. And then finally, Katherine Oxenberg, who many may remember from her role on Dynasty as Fallon or many of her other acting roles, she became the worst nightmare of Keith Raniere, a celebrity who turned on him and used her celebrity status to bring him down. The same thing is happening with Scientology, with the actress Leah Remini. She left Scientology, where she was raised and brought up by her parents to be a Scientologist. And now she's their worst nightmare because she knows all their inner workings. And she has she had the show on A&E, Scientology, The Aftermath, and now she has the podcast Fair Game. And she's constantly articulating the stories of former members and the terrible things that have happened in Scientology. And so on one hand, some of these groups will use a celebrity like a poster boy or girl to recruit people. But if some celebrity leaves, that can be a two-edged sword.
Yeah, that could be their worst nightmare because of the press and that person's ability to educate people and to reach a large number of people to let them know about the abuse that takes place in that organization. We are just out of time here. Before we wrap up the show, can you, any resources? I know this is my number one resource, and as our YouTube watchers will see, I got it tagged. What are some other resources that you recommend for therapists to kind of look at to learn more?
Well, I think the book the book Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, the book influenced by Robert Cialdini, the book Cults in Our Midst by the clinical psychologist Margaret Singer and the sociologist Janja Lalich are all good books. And what I did in the book Cults Inside Out are several things. Number one, it's a history of many of the preeminent cults. And then it's also an examination of smaller groups that many people don't know about but have been reported about. And so there's a narrative in the book where you're hearing the voices of victims, and they're consistently coalescing around many of the same issues, the same things that happened to them, the same isolation and so forth. And so the book, Cults Inside Out, is very carefully footnoted. There are over 1,000 research footnotes in the book, and there's also an 18-page bibliography. So the book covers a history of cults. It covers what is a destructive cult, a chapter on defining that, a chapter on what is cult brainwashing, the sensational label for coercive persuasion to gain undue influence in destructive cults. And then what is this whole cult intervention process like, and case examples of that. And there's also a chapter on recovery. So in when I wrote the book, I was thinking to myself, if someone couldn't be deprogrammed, but they were struggling with their involvement in a particular group or an abusive controlling relationship, could I take them on a journey beginning with chapter one and going through the book where they could kind of unpack and unwind their programming on their own? And so in a sense, that's what the book is about. But there are a number of really great books. And there's also an organization called the International Cultic Studies Association, which has a component for mental health professionals concerned about cults. They have seminars. They have a magazine, a newsletter. And, of course, there is the Cult Education Institute, which can be found at culteducation.com, which is a free public online library where people can go and just use the database and get all kinds of information about the things we've been talking about.
Awesome. There's so much out there. You know, I know our podcast is only structured for an hour, but for our listeners, like our podcast, we just aim to give you a taste. And so Rick just kind of gave you all the other places that you guys can go to for additional information, especially his book, which is just jam packed. It's like a textbook. I really feel like in our higher education programs, that should be a textbook that therapists should have just for, it's a great reference and also a great understanding into cults and the manipulation, the psychological techniques that they use for their benefit to gain control of its members. So, well, thank you so much, Rick, for coming on the show. Stay tuned to the end of the show for therapists to learn how to obtain continuing education credit hours. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Rick. And
Thank you, Sarah. It's been fun, in a way.
I know, right? You hate to say that cults are fun, but it's been fun to kind of help put this spin on it and help educate therapists on what we can do to better help this big issue that goes on in our everyday society. There's hundreds of thousands of cults, like, and right in your local area, you know, that we need to be aware of and know how to intervene and know the red flags for. So thank you so much, and we'll see you all next time on our next episode of Therapeutic Perspective.
If you listen to the podcast and you would like to obtain continuing education credit hours from NBCC, please check out our website at therapeuticperspective.com. You will first need to click on the show that you just listened to, then the Take This Course button. From there, you will complete the payment process and attest that you listened to the show in its entirety. After the payment is processed, you will take a 10-question quiz, followed by an evaluation so that we can better serve you. After these steps are complete, you will be given your certificate, which can be printed or stored on your therapeuticperspective.com account. If you need any help or support in the process, please email us at therapeuticperspectivepodcast@gmail.com.